From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Today is Tuesday, February 8th. I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. Protests today in Cairo are the biggest yet. Hundreds of thousands of Egyptians turned out to demand the resignation of President Hosni Mubarak. The American news media are telling the Egypt story in different ways. There's the "We are all Egyptians" narrative. That's the one about freedom and democracy. And then there's the narrative favored by Glenn Beck.
You've heard the protesters, not all of them, but many of them, hate America. They don't want to be like us. They want to kill us.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, partnering with Mended Hearts to provide online and hospital support to newly diagnosed heart disease patients. Learn more at mendedhearts.org. And by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Today, Egypt's vice president vowed that there will be no reprisals against Egyptians who've been staging mass protests for 2 weeks now, and he'd already announced a plan to transfer power from the regime of President Hosni Mubarak to a new government. The promises, though, were not enough to dissuade hundreds of thousands of people from turning out into Tahrir Square in central Cairo today. The demonstrators are still calling for Mubarak to resign. Mubarak is still refusing to budge. Correspondent Thanasis Kambanis is just outside Tahrir Square right now. Thanasis, what is the scene like there? Is there any evidence that the demonstrators are starting to lose momentum?
That's what people were saying yesterday and early this morning around Cairo, but they were really blown away by what happened inside Tahrir Square today. It was almost impossible to move through the square. It took me something like half an hour to go about 200 feet at one point. But what's really different about today, this is the biggest, possibly, protest they've had so far. And what's different about it is there's a huge number of first-time visitors to the square. Egyptians who have maybe cast a sympathetic eye, maybe a wary eye on the protests, were really won over. And a lot of them said to me it was because of the interview on television last night with the released Google executive, Wael Ghanem. He gave this teary, very emotional, very personal interview about his arrest, the role he played in organizing the original protests, and his mistreatment at the hands of the police. And somehow that convinced a huge number of middle-class Egyptians that these protests were something that was important to them and to their dignity as well. And that's literally dozens of people told me that's why they came today for the first time.
Now, that's very interesting. I wonder if this man, Wael Ghanem of Google, if he has been visible at the protests today at all, and whether or not they're elevating him to the position of leadership in the demonstrations, whether or not he wants one.
The most eager constituency to see a leadership in these protests is the Western media. The protesters themselves don't seem in any way enamored of the idea of having a single leader. Now, that being said, there's a huge groundswell of affection for Ghanem. A Facebook page was created called Wael Ghanem Speaks For Me, and at last time I checked, it had something like 40,000 people who had liked it. When he came to the square this afternoon, he was mobbed. He delivered a speech. People went crazy. People are following his tweets. But it's unlikely, in my view, that he or any other single person is going to emerge as the leader of these protests, although I think for the middle class, he will probably be the face of this movement.
And maybe for the, as you say, for the outside media as well. But Wael Ghanem, when the Facebook page says Wael Ghanem Speaks For Me, what's he saying that's resonating so much?
Well, he's eloquently summarizing the message of all these protesters, which is that Egypt is a society of competent people who have been held back by a corrupt leadership that has basically distorted everything from the ability of young people to get jobs, to have free speech, all the way up to the justice system and the rampant use of torture. One of the great twists of his release was he was released from detention through the intercession of a very powerful member of Hosni Mubarak's party, the National Democratic Party. As soon as he came out, he said, "The guy who got me released should resign and be put on trial, and just because I happen to be someone who gets a lot of attention doesn't mean I should get special treatment and all the other people in detention shouldn't be released as well.
One of the things you've written about in your dispatch today is about the groups of men who are sleeping in shifts beneath the treads of the army tanks that mark the northern perimeter of the protests. Who are these people?
It's an incredibly diverse bunch. At one point, I was talking to a young doctor. Later, I was talking to a man who runs a papyrus store in a village up in Upper Egypt in a tourist zone, and he was sitting next to a microbus driver. I mean, this is a very working-class profession from a very gritty part of Cairo, and these guys are sitting literally arm-in-arm, and in this case, the microbus driver had brought his three-year-old daughter. It's something kind of fantastical to see anywhere, and especially in a stratified society like Egypt's. I mean, these are the bottom of the social ladder sitting next to a doctor, arm-in-arm, linked in this shared mission to prevent the tanks from moving any further.
And the tanks weren't moving.
Yes. In fact, the other night, the army tried to disperse the guys sleeping under the treads by firing guns into the air, and it just energized the crowd. The army said, please move. We want to advance these tanks. They started firing bullets in the air, and the people just went crazy and just crowded more and more people around the tanks and basically said, you know, go ahead. There's only one way to move these, and that's to kill us.
I wonder if you can just finish up by talking about the current position of the White House and how it's being greeted there, because the White House is saying that it backs the transition process announced by the Egyptian government, meaning that it's not backing the demonstrators' main demand, that being that Mubarak leave now. Are the protesters reacting to that word from the White House at all?
The protesters aren't backing down at all. I mean, they're taking a simple maximalist position, which is they're willing to negotiate everything, but only after Mubarak is gone. What the White House is doing is actually the same thing that the Egyptian military and the Egyptian ruling regime is doing, which is betting simply that these protests will run out of steam before they can wrest further concessions from the regime. And I'd say it's really too soon to tell. I mean, there's a bias in favor of power winning out over popular uprisings, but there are always the revolutions that defy the norm. And this one already has. And I guess I would caution anybody who tries to write this off as you know, already running out of steam or on its last legs. It's really just too soon to tell. And a day like today reminds us each step of the way when all the experts and the powers that be in Egypt and in the White House have thought nothing would happen or have thought it was over, this movement has defied expectations. So I would just voice a note of caution and say it's not clear they're going to win, but it's also not at all clear that they're going to lose.
Thanasis Kambanis is outside Cairo's Tahrir Square. He is a columnist for the Boston Globe and author of the book A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. Nice to talk to you, Thanasis. Thank you.
A pleasure.
Now, it's the nature of the news media to try to tell good stories, and the protests in Egypt certainly make for a good story. But different news media in America are telling that story in different ways. As the world's Alex Galifant tells us, it's all about the plot line.
There's a competition going on in American media, a contest to explain what's happening in Egypt.
As you simply flip the channels, you will hear different narratives about what is taking place there.
Jeffrey Halverson is one of the authors of Master Narratives of Islamic Extremism. It's a book that describes a set of core stories that animate the likes of Al-Qaeda. But Halverson says we all rely on narratives to help us make sense of the world, even if they don't tell anything like the whole story.
Narratives function as a shorthand where you play on existing structures, existing characters or archetypes that are readily understood.
And right now, Egypt is getting the narrative treatment. First, there's the We Are All Egyptians story, the one that's purely about freedom and democracy. Bud Goodall, a professor of communications at Arizona State University, says it's not surprising that that narrative resonates with Americans.
Democracy is part of our national story. It's, you know, grounded in the pilgrims coming here for freedom of expression, freedom of religion, economic opportunity. So when we see democracy being called for by people in Egypt, we cheer.
Just like we did in 1989, for instance, when the people of Berlin joined hands across a broken wall. But there's another narrative being used to explain Egypt.
This is not about freedom-loving people just wanting to be free. This is a complex story.
Here's Glenn Beck of Fox News.
You've heard the protesters, not all of them, but many of them hate America. They don't want to be like us. They want to kill us.
This narrative depends on the idea that instability and unrest in the Middle East can mean nothing but trouble for Americans, who remember September 11th all too clearly. Again, Bud Goodall.
Every time they hear something about a group, some sort of revolutionary group, that it's one that's going to be violent, it's going to be extreme, and it's going to be hating the United States.
There, too, a supporting example from history is available. The overthrow of the Shah of Iran in 1979.
There was nothing but sheer delight on the faces of the demonstrators who took to the streets of the capital in their thousands to celebrate the departure of the man they have hated for so long.
That popular revolution did not turn out well for American interests, which in that part of the world often coincide with Israeli interests. Few would argue that the most democratic nation in the region, Israel, is right to fear out-and-out chaos among its neighbors. The trouble is that those two storylines, democracy good, chaos bad, don't fit together very well. Neither is nuanced enough to accommodate the other. Both narratives are powerful because they're simple, and both have found a home in Cairo's Tahrir Square. The square presents a manageable, neatly defined stage on which to project the storyline of choice: freedom-loving protesters or anti-American hordes. Tahrir Square has also become a stage for media personalities.
Watching TV last week, I wasn't sure who I most wanted to see leave, Mubarak or Anderson Cooper.
Howard Rosenberg is the former TV critic of the Los Angeles Times. He applauds much of CNN's reporting from Egypt and the bravery of all reporters who withstood assault by pro-Mubarak supporters. But still,
when other TV reporters had found ways to report without theatrics, even after finding it too dangerous to report from the square, Anderson and his team telecast live while hunkered down in what he called an undisclosed location. In fact, CNN even ran a slide underneath it, undisclosed location, as if to advertise it as some kind of TV drama.
Rosenberg says this is another kind of narrative, a story that places a premium on high-stakes drama. And it's available to news organizations, even if they're unwilling to pick a side in the choice between narratives of democracy and chaos. In recent weeks, some Americans have turned to a news source from beyond these shores, Al Jazeera English, produced in the Gulf state of Qatar. You can watch it online or on TV in just a handful of places across the US. And in recent days, Al Jazeera has in turn been casting an eye on American coverage of Egypt.
Egypt is suddenly big news in the US. But while the message of the Egyptian youth may have been given some attention on US networks, do the Americans understand what they are saying? The young protesters' call for the removal of Mubarak and his regime was upstaged by concern for U.S. interest and the possible repercussions for Israel.
Al Jazeera English presents an alternative set of narratives to those told by American media. Its treatment of Islam, for instance, is very different. Its coverage of Israel and the occupied territories is very different. And perhaps most importantly, America is not at the center of the story. That's not to say Al Jazeera's narratives are more true or false than any other, only that they are different. It all makes it harder for Americans to figure out how to be on the so-called right side of history. A poll by the Pew Research Center today suggests Americans aren't sure what to make of Egypt. Some think the effects of the protests on the US will be positive, more think they will be negative. For the past 30 years, the United States has helped write Egypt's story. That story is over. And right now, people don't know what the new one will be. For The World, I'm Alex Galifant.
The World's correspondents have been reporting on the unrest in Cairo since it began 2 weeks ago. You can explore all our coverage at theworld.org/Egypt. This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from the Medtronic Foundation, committed to changing the way the world treats chronic disease. Learn more at Medtronic.com. Medtronic, innovating for life.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. The biggest migration ever from country to city is taking place in China. Almost half the Chinese people now live in cities. Most move there for economic opportunity and often for the excitement of urban life. But here's the question. Are they happy? The answer depends on which city they're living in. An annual survey by the state news agency Xinhua and the China Association of Mayors ranks cities by happiness. And among the top winners in the latest poll is the southwestern city of Kunming. The world's Mary Kay Magstead tells us why.
Kunming attracts snowbirds. There's the avian variety, seagulls from Siberia that come and hang out on Kunming's Green Lake each winter. Then there are the human ones. This woman, Zheng Yuandong, says it's spring all the time here. The air is clear, the produce is fresh and cheap, and the people are pretty nice. Zheng is originally from a colder part of China. She now splits her time between Kunming and Florida, where she has family. She comes here, to Green Lake, to join others in freeform dancing. Her preferred style is an exuberant cross between a samba and a cha-cha. A much younger woman swoops, using two giant fans, like butterfly wings. Her name is Wu Xiaojue, and it doesn't surprise her that Kunming has come out as one of China's happiest cities. She thinks it has a lot going for it.
First thing is the people, do you know? Kunming people is very friendly and very warm. I think people is the core competition of every city. Because people is alive, right? The things is dead.
The annual survey on China's happiest city really sets out to measure quality of life in objective measures like air quality, housing prices, working hours, and availability of good medical care, and in more subjective ways, what residents themselves feel about their city and what the survey calls its milk of human kindness. Based on all measures, Beijing and Shanghai didn't even make the top 10. Sure, they're big and cosmopolitan and incredibly dynamic, but they're also expensive, polluted, gridlocked, and a little hard-edged. Many residents of both cities report feeling overworked, stressed out, and sleep-deprived. For years, other cities in China have tried to emulate the Beijing-Shanghai model, tearing down intimate old neighborhoods and tea houses, building up tall, imposing buildings and wide roads with fewer spaces that encourage social interaction. Suicide rates among the elderly in these cities have climbed as older Chinese find themselves torn from their old communities and isolated in high-rise apartment buildings. So it's not an entirely trivial thing, as China's cities continue to grow, that its association of mayors is paying attention to what kind of cities make people happier. One aspect they may not have considered comes from Xiongguan Lan, a 40-year-old farmer from hundreds of miles away from Kunming. She comes here on the off-season to pick up extra cash, shining shoes in a central shopping area. She says police in other cities are more harsh with the likes of her, migrant workers doing whatever they can. Whether through compassion or neglect of duty, she says the police here are almost as mild as the weather. For The World, I'm Mary Kay Magstead, Kunming.
You can see just how happy the people of Kunming are. We've got a slideshow of happy dancing, happy gardening, and yes, even more happiness. It's at theworld.org. For today's GeoQuiz, we're searching for an ocean strait between the North Sea and Kattegat Bay. Denmark lies to the south, Norway to the north, and Sweden to the east. This waterway played a historic role. The Germans sought to control it during World War I and II, and in 1916, a major sea battle was fought there. These days, you're more likely to experience a lobster safari along the strait in one of the fishing villages in western Sweden. We'll go on a lobster safari, in fact, and visit with a local chef, but first we need you to name the strait where the lobsters are running. Don't have much time on this one. The answer's coming right up. Well, it's now right up. The answer we're looking for is the Skagerrak Strait. Many restaurants in West Sweden are part of a local food movement, one that includes lobster from the Skagerrak. Producer Jake Warga takes us now on a foodie tour.
My first impressions of Sweden came from the crazy chef on The Muppet Show who battled with rebellious lobsters. An impression that, well, may not be that far off.
From början, härifrån, och vi är I Ljungskile, and in English. Okay, my name is Mattias Jansson, and I'm the head chef at Villa Sjötorp here in Ljungskile, the west coast of Sweden.
On the coast of West Sweden, I did find a chef cooking lobster at the B&B where I was staying.
You do a sauce on the shells?
He was in the kitchen wrestling a lobster bouillon. He's also a professional juggler.
I actually think like all the chefs are like a little bit crazy because not everybody can take it. So you get your lobster and then you pick out the meat. You do a sauce on the shells. You put the lobster in the sauce later on. It's perfect. Then you use everything.
I discovered there's a local food movement going on in Sweden.
We only buy like our cheese from small farms. All the nice restaurants in Sweden kind of does that. You know, it's not like you call your distributor and say, we want meat. You don't want some beef from Brazil or something. You want it like from around here.
West Sweden is famous for its seafood, especially, and oddly to me, its pickled herring. But luckily, it's lobster season.
They always try to bite me when I take them outside the box, but must be very careful. They are fast.
Curious about where the lobster I ate came from, I went out on a lobster safari. Yes, a lobster safari.
My name is Per Karlsson from Evert Sjöbo. We work with lobster safari, oyster safari, and mackerel and crab safari.
For the lobster safari, Per and his brother take people out on their wooden boat to haul in traps. Then it's back to the boathouse to boil water and eat some very fresh seafood.
One yellowfish and one crab.
Per hauls up one box, and inside is a massive lobster, which I named Garlic.
So how old is Garlic?
Let me guess, 20 years.
20 years old?
This is a female.
The local food movement is happening in the big cities as well. From West Sweden, I went to the capital, Stockholm, to a trendy restaurant and hotel.
I would say we're definitely the trendiest.
Definitely. Cool people were everywhere. I spoke with...
My name is Samuel Laulajainen, and I am responsible for all restaurants, bars, and food and beverage within the hotel, Scandic Malmen.
I asked him about the local food movement.
That's a trend in Stockholm as well. If you know the farm, you put the farm on the menu. We're trying to buy everything local. You know where the meat is coming from, where the potatoes are coming from. Our guests are getting more and more interested in that.
And they're very serious about sourcing their food, even down to the coffee.
And our restaurant manager is now going to Kenya to look at the coffee farms, to see how it's produced and how the workers are treated and so on. I mean, that's the way it has to be.
At the end of the Muppet skit, it's the lobsters that get the upper hand and attack the chef. But today in Sweden, bites are a source of local pride.
What the hell?
That was Jake Warga in West Sweden. You can check out Jake's photos of his lobster safari there at theworld.org. News headlines are coming up. This is PRI, Public Radio International. Lisa Mullins. Coming up, a Marine commander in Afghanistan explains the lay of the land to the man who will replace him.
This district is like an iceberg. When you first get here, you have a vision of what you can see above the waterline. But the really important things, they're under the waterline.
Also, we remember a poet of two rivers, the Nile and the Seine.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, partnering with Mended Hearts to provide online and hospital support to newly diagnosed heart disease patients. Learn more at mendedhearts.org. And by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The similarities between Egypt and Yemen right now are striking. The leaders of both countries have been in charge for about 30 years, and during that time, corruption, poverty, and oppression have been a way of life. And both countries receive substantial amounts of military aid from Washington. Here's one more similarity. The opposition in both countries is stronger than it's been in a generation. The BBC's Natalia Antalava has just spent the past week reporting in Yemen. She just arrived back in London. There are, as we said, Natalia, so many similarities with Egypt. But what are the differences in Yemen? Do the activists in Yemen represent a critical mass of people who are internet savvy, as we see in Egypt?
There are very striking similarities, as you said. But, of course, underneath the similarities, if you dig just a little deeper, the differences are too striking. The discontent is widespread and massive in Yemen, and there is no question that the Yemenis have been glued to their television sets, watching every single development in Egypt, really cheering for the Egyptians. I've not met a single person in Yemen, even among the government people, who didn't feel for the Egyptians, who didn't support them. But Yemen is also a very different case. It's an extremely poor country. It's much poorer than Egypt. It's a very tribal society. It's a society where internet, as you said, is not available to the masses the way it is available in Egypt. There are about only 200,000 users, which is, of course, a tiny number for the country of 23 million. Another difference is the fact that women are not participating as much as they did in Egypt. It's a very conservative society, and some of the women that I've been talking to when I was in Sana'a were very anti-government, very anti-president, but when it came to me asking them, well, will you go out and protest, they would say, oh, no, that's not our place. That's for men to do.
And does that make a difference, by the way, in terms of the power of the activists? Because it does seem like...
Oh, absolutely. I think it makes a huge difference. You're basically eliminating half of your population. And if you look at what's happening in Cairo and how active women have been in participating in this protest, of course, that makes a difference. Another difference is the fact that President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who has been in power for many, many years, one of the things that he's best known for is his ability to just maneuver his way out of trouble. It's a tribal Yemeni society, it's still very much a tribal society, and for decades, President Saleh has had to play these different interests and different groups and different tribes, often against each other, but basically balancing their interests and balancing them. He's very good at it, and he proved his shrewdness once again when last week, just before the Yemeni's Day of Rage, as they called it, he came out and made a whole load of concessions to their position, told them that we will have a national dialogue. He promised to step down in 2013. He said that he would not appoint his son as his successor. Once again, the echoes of Egypt. And it does seem to have appeased the opposition somewhat, because now they're saying, well, we'll have to give it a chance. We'll have to wait and see. We'll have to see if he lives up to the promises. When it comes to the young people, it makes them just only more angry, because they're saying that we've been there before. He's made exact same promises before. He has said he wouldn't run, and then he did run. They don't believe him. They just want him out.
Right. And at this point, he's saying that he will step down in 2013. He won't allow his son to run for president. We've heard that in other countries as well. President Saleh has also said that he's going to boost the standard of living of his people, but this calls for money that he doesn't have. Is there any way he could make good on that?
The poverty is shocking. In Sana'a, outside the capital, it's even worse. And they are headed towards the economic decline. It's a country that's running out not only of oil, they're running out of water. Some of the forecasts say that by 2014, Sana'a is not going to have drinking water. It's a country that faces massive problems, including two insurgencies that are being fought in the north and in the south, including active Al-Qaeda cells throughout the country, including the capital. And the government simply doesn't have the money. Of course, the fact that the corruption levels are so high doesn't help either. So no doubt he is in an extremely difficult position.
All right, just back from Yemen, the BBC's Natalia Antalava. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The war in Afghanistan has been going on for more than 9 years now, and the fighting's getting more fierce. More than 700 service members were killed in Afghanistan last year. That made 2010 the deadliest year of the war. The U.S. plans to start drawing down troops this year, and the Afghan government has pledged to take over security of the country by 2014. Until then, American fighting men and women will be cycling in and out of Afghanistan. Reporter Monica Campbell followed one U.S. Marine as he prepared to lead his battalion.
All right, good morning, gentlemen. I'm Sergeant Corbett, ma'am.
Marine Lieutenant Colonel Chris Dixon is briefed before heading out in an armored convoy to small command posts here in Afghanistan's Musa Qala district. It's part of Helmand province, Taliban country, a land of opium poppy crops, and where insurgents lace the desert land and villages with IEDs or roadside bombs. It's Dixon's first time to this part of Afghanistan. He's doing recon now before coming back this spring to lead a Marine battalion here.
Okay. This is the first time getting out here that I do a leader's reconnaissance, get a true feel for what I thought I know versus what is reality. You know, we find that a lot with battalion commanders. We do a lot of study and research to try to learn what's going on. But then once you actually get into Afghanistan, you find that reality many times changes what you thought you knew.
Riding next to Dixon is Marine Lieutenant Colonel Dan Canfield. He commands the 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, operating here now. He'll soon hand the reins over to Dixon. Canfield's advice? Know where to position your best Marines and employ young Afghan men to keep them from being snatched up by the Taliban. Canfield also adds,
I don't think anything can prepare you for the reality. The cliche, if you will, is this district is like an iceberg. When you first get here, you have a vision of what you can see above the waterline. But the really important things that you need to know, understand, take time, and they're under the waterline.
As we roll along, villagers stand outside khaki-colored mud huts to see the Marines' mammoth mine-resistant vehicles. A barefoot Afghan girl in a jade-green dress shouts for candy. An elderly man with one leg leans on a stick. We reach the top of what looks like a large dusty molehill. About 50 Marines occupy this post. Dixon enters their small, crowded war room. It's crammed with color-coded maps. Red spots mark Taliban territory. Green means Marine-friendly zones. Flat screens show 360-degree satellite views of the desert terrain. Robert Rain, a platoon commander here, briefs Dixon on recent operations.
So we pushed Bravo 1st Platoon, pushed west last night, and took up a defensive position south of the Chagali Bazaar.
So they did they? What did you do? Clear and zone?
No, sir. We
at the outposts, Dixon always makes sure to sip chai tea with the Afghan soldiers working with the Marines. One Afghan soldier asks for stronger radio so that they can overhear the Taliban chatter better. The soldier also warns of more fighting come spring.
Right now, you see, since it's winter time, the grass are low, stuff's not growing. Once it's grow like corn, you're going to get green and tall, and Taliban can hide those places and they come under attack.
As the tour wraps up, Dixon thinks about what's ahead.
I am responsible for not just security and war fighting, but helping to enable governance. And the squad leaders that you saw today are the ones that will every day are interacting with the populace. And we are relying on these young men, in my case, because it's an infantry unit, relying on these young men to do it right and do it right every time.
For the world, I'm Monica Campbell, embedded with the U.S. Marines in Helmand Province, Afghanistan.
Monica Campbell has been reporting in Afghanistan for a project called BaseTrack. It's funded by the Knight Foundation. The reporters and photographers with BaseTrack have been using the internet and social media to chronicle the lives of the members of the 1st Battalion, 8th Marines in Afghanistan, until this past weekend. That's when the Marines asked the BaseTrack journalist to leave. Photographer Teru Kawayama started this project last September. He is now back in New York. We aired an interview with you just 12 days ago, Teru, about BaseTrack. But now, suddenly, as of this past weekend, the news came that the plug has been pulled on your project. I want to hear all about that. But first, can you just briefly tell us what BaseTrack is all about?
Sure. BaseTrack, we've been calling it a media experiment because I don't know what else to call it. We basically have a small team of embedded reporters and photographers who rotate in and out with the 1st Battalion, 8th Marines in Helmand, Afghanistan. They send out a stream of reporting, photographs, observations, interviews, and we publish those on a website. And from there, we push it out into social media sites like Facebook and Twitter.
And the primary audience is for the family members, friends of the Marines who you're following.
Right, that's the core audience.
Okay, so this has been going on, as we said, since the battalion has been deployed in Helmand province in Afghanistan. That was back in September. You had intended to stay with the battalion possibly through April, but it looks like that's not going to happen. How come?
Well, it's pretty mystifying, and we don't actually know. We don't have a very clear picture on who it is who's pulling the plug on the embed. And actually, they won't even say that they're disembedding us because apparently, for us to be officially disembedded, we would have to have been determined to have done something wrong. So the language we received is that we're being asked to leave.
You got the language in a letter?
Yeah, we got a letter from a public affairs officer, a junior officer who's on another larger base in Helmand. I'm quite sure this didn't originate with this lieutenant. Who it did originate with, we're not really sure.
The memo said that BaseTrack was asked to leave, quote, due to perceived operational security violations on portions of their website. These concerns are legitimate. Specifically, the website's tie into Google Maps to display friendly force locations. That's the end of the quote. So for you, Teru, what's the response to these concerns that you were basically mapping the location of the Marines in various parts of Helmand province? They say that was unsafe.
Well, my immediate response was to write back and say, if there's an operational security issue, let's work together immediately and resolve it because we don't want to put out any information that would endanger any of these Marines. But they haven't responded to that at all. The other thing, too, is that the locations of these bases aren't secret. They're not covert special forces or CIA safe houses. These are heavily barricaded and highly visible outposts with, you know, blast walls and flags flying over them. They're not hidden at all. The other thing, too, is the mapping that we do is offset. We were actually much more concerned about revealing specific GPS coordinates than the Marines were, actually. So despite the fact that they had earlier complained that the GPS coordinates weren't accurate enough, we made sure that our system offsets the flags on the Google Maps. So they show general locations, but they're not usable for targeting purposes.
Okay, and that was the main concern, because one would think from the outside that if you are mapping where the battalion was, that by definition you could be compromising their security because they could become targets. On the other hand, you're saying that it was offset a little bit, so it wasn't an exact pinpoint location. But also one would think that this would have been handled and cleared in the very beginning before you even got the go-ahead, was it not?
Well, this is the other very curious thing. I mean, this website's been up for 6 or 7 months now. It's curious that it suddenly became an issue now.
So do you doubt that that's the real reason?
The only thing that's pretty clear to me is that the stated reasons why we're being asked to leave are not true. I don't know what the real reasons are. That's the thing that's quite mystifying. But it's not OPSEC. It's not operational security. Mm-hmm. The other reason that we were given, that there just simply isn't enough space for the BaseTrack embeds, is also clearly not true, because there's other media organizations who have embeds right now with 1-8, and there's a couple more who have people on their way in. So something changed over the course of the last week, and we don't know what it is.
So is the website going to stay up?
Well, until somebody at Public Affairs or at the Pentagon will tell us that there's a real reason to take it down, yeah. But they're not really answering their email on that. So I don't know what to say, although I did immediately offer to work with them to mitigate any genuine operational security issues. But they don't seem to be interested.
We should say we've put in some requests for more information as well and haven't heard back just yet. You seem to be rolling with the punches on this project, but does this outcome, and it sounds like there's more to be told in the story, but does this constitute the equivalent of a failure of the project for you?
If anything, to my mind, this constitutes the demonstration of a success. When I started this project off, my biggest challenge was, how do I demonstrate that it worked? And what I see is that we created a form of communication that seems to be wildly popular with the families of the Marines. The discussions that took place on Facebook and other social media sites were incredibly civil and well thought out. And somehow, somewhere, someone who doesn't want to identify themselves decided that there was something happening that was important enough that it should be stopped. I don't know how to demonstrate success better than that.
Thank you very much, Teiru Koyama, who started Base Track, which intended to follow the 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, throughout their deployment in Afghanistan. He spoke to us from New York. Teiru, thank you.
Thank you.
And you can find more on Base Track at theworld.org/Base Track. There is an online forum there where two Marines from the 1-8 Battalion answered listener questions. This is PRI. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Just ahead, a soundtrack to the wave of unrest sweeping Arab nations. First, though, another artistic footnote to the demonstrations in Egypt and elsewhere. Egyptian-born poet André Chédid died in Paris on Sunday. She was 90 years old and a well-known figure on the French literary scene. Here's more from The World's Marco Werman.
She was known to many in Paris as La Dame des Deux Rives, the woman who came from the banks of two rivers, the Seine and the Nile. French President Nicolas Sarkozy said yesterday that Chédid was part of a movement of new cosmopolitan writers who brought about a literary renaissance in France after the Second World War. Chédid was born in 1920 in Cairo and was raised in three languages, Arabic, English, and French. She wrote her first work in English, but when she moved to France, her writing switched.
Il est passé le sourire qui vivait de ta lèvre.
This is André Chédid reading one of her poems from a CD with musical accompaniment.
On danse partout sur ta jeune mort ce soir. Et je suis de la danse. Et je suis de la vie.
Chédid was not an activist writer. Still, she held a nostalgia for Egypt and the Orient that preoccupied her writing. It didn't translate into widespread appeal in Egypt, but it provided anyone who had read André Chédid's writing with a solid context for understanding what's been going on there. As one critic pointed out today, Chédid's work consistently echoed her faith in the people of Egypt, their humanity, their sense of humor, and their patience. That Egyptian patience was cited last week by the spokesman in exile for the Muslim Brotherhood. Kamal el-Halbawi told us that Egyptian protesters went about their Sunni way of reform calmly, steeled by their patience with a government they have struggled quietly with for many years.
The Sunni way of reform and the Sunni way of looking at the authority and the power and the government, that they respect the government so much and be patient many, many years.
It's hard to know what André Chédid felt about the protests in Egypt just before she passed away. What is certain is that today Shadid has been the subject of numerous appreciations in France, and not just amongst the literati. Her poetry has also been embraced by young pop music fans. Shadid's grandson, Mathieu Shadid, who also goes by the name M, often adapts André Shadid's poetry for his songs. This one, Bonobo, is especially well known, and it helps cement André Shadid's words for a new generation of readers who didn't get to enjoy her writing while she was alive. For The World, I'm Marco Werman.
Oh, mes cousins masculins, féminins. Oh, mes Benjamins qui se prétendent.
You can watch a video of M performing Bonobo with his siblings at theworld.org. The poetic tradition in North Africa has also woven its way into more modern forms of expression. Rappers and hip-hop artists from Algeria to Egypt have been casting a critical eye on governments and dictators for years. Their rhymes have become a kind of soundtrack for revolution in the wake of all the recent unrest. Now, one group of Libyan exiles has assembled some of the best tracks into a compilation. The World's Clark Boyd reports.
Abdullah Jarrat has spent the past weeks glued to his computer and his phone. The 28-year-old Libyan-American watched as Tunisians rose up in protest, and he listened as Tunisian rapper El General wondered aloud, in a track called Long Live Tunis, if that protest might spread. This is a message to other rulers, El General says. Those who have been betrayed, he continues, Egypt, Algeria, Libya, Morocco, all must be liberated. Abdullah Jarrat shares that sentiment. He's part of a loose group of young Libyan exiles who, a couple of years ago, created a website called Khalas, or Enough, as in Enough of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi.
It wasn't an organization in the traditional sense, you know, with clear leadership, but rather a sentiment about enough. We've had enough, and the word Khalas, because it had a sense of absolute that you kind of fed up, but not just Khalas, but a sense of Khalas, like a sense of loyalty to that cause as well.
That sounds like the feeling in Cairo's Tahrir Square right now as well, a feeling that Egyptian hip-hop artist Rami Danjouan captures in this track called Against the Government.
Yeah. ضد الحكومة ضد الحكومة
ضد الحكومة ضد البلطجة والظلم ضد الحكومة ضد الحاكم والحكم ضد الحكومة وحبل الظلم طويل ضد الحكومة وعندي ألف دليل دمك مسيحينه قتلك محللينه وطنك مبهدلينه دينك.
If that sounds like a laundry list of complaints against the Egyptian government, well, that's because it is. Your blood, the government shedding it, he rhymes. Your nation, they've exhausted it. Your religion, they've targeted it. Your portion, they've swallowed it. Abdullah Jarrat says that hip-hop, with its historical focus on the underprivileged, is a good artistic vehicle.
You see really the frustrations, you know, which is where this music, its origins or the kind of wellspring of it comes from that. Because no matter what I do, there will be somebody there to ruin it. This is an ongoing struggle. This is a struggle of that youth have taken upon their shoulders because they see an opportunity to make their future better. These are the voices of their youth.
And that's why Jarrat and his colleagues at Enough decided to make a mixtape. They collected some of the most powerful voices in rap and hip-hop from across North Africa and made a compilation available as a free download. It includes voices such as Algeria's Lofte Double Canon, a man who holds degrees in math and engineering and who has been relentlessly sticking it to the Algerian government with his rhyme since the early 1990s. Here's his letter to Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika.
مشني جاي نضرب الشيطة ومشني جاي باش نشعل نار جديدة مشني جاي بنميمة تاع جريدة بالعكس اني جايب لك ميساج تاع شبيبة.
Mr. President, I have brought you a message from the young, Double Canon says. The young are only thinking about immigrating. The majority see their futures and they look foggy. Enough is calling the mix Mishbaid, or not far, as in the countries are not far from each other. And neither are their leaders, says Abdullah Jarrat. You can see it, he says, in the image chosen for the cover of the mix.
If you see the image on the cover, you see the faces of the different dictators in the region, kind of almost like a slot machine where they're, you know, you got Mubarak's eyes on Bouteflika's face and they're all kind of burning and covered in ash. And that's the sense that there's kind of a shared experience between these people and we wanted to express that.
Jarrat says that there's a call for Libyans to take to the streets on February 17th. That date, he says, commemorates two instances in recent Libyan history when Gaddafi's regime cracked down brutally on dissent. The mix includes a track from a Libyan rapper who goes by the pseudonym Ibn Tabi. What do you say, Ibn Tabi, about the people's hearts, the song asks. Will they stand against the enemy? Will they sacrifice as they did in Tunisia? Ibn Tabi answers, I know that only God knows how long I will live. For the world, this is Clark Boyd.
You can find out how to download that free album of North African rap at our website, which is theworld.org. You can also see videos and find links to the artists. Coming up tomorrow on The World, accusations that a college in California is a front for illegal immigration. That and a lot more tomorrow on The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Lisa Mullins. Thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. The Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. The WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet.
PRI, Public Radio International.